Toronto, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitapoye and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون يُنفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ ثُمَّ لَا يُتْبِعُونَ مَا أَنْفَقُوا مَنًّا وَلَا أَذًى ثُمَّ لَا يُتْبِعُونَ مَا أَنْفَقُوا مَنًّا وَلَا أَذًى لَهُمْ أَجْرُهُمْ عِنْدَ رَبِّهِمْ وَلَا خَوْفٌ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا هُمْ يَحْزَنُونَ صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's president officially welcomes his Turkish counterpart, who is in Tehran for a trilateral summit involving Russia and the situation in Syria. Global oil prices rise after the return of U.S. President Joe Biden from Saudi Arabia, where he failed to persuade Riyadh to boost its oil output. And the European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kiev to 2.5 billion euros. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president officially welcomes his Turkish counterpart, who is in Tehran to attend a trilateral summit on Syria's tensions. The two presidents and the Russian counterpart will hold the summit later on Tuesday. It's part of the Astana peace process, which was launched in 2017 at the initiative of Tehran, Moscow, and Ankara. The three top officials are planned to exchange viewpoints on how to reduce tensions in conflict zones in Syria. They will also discuss Syria's recent tensions with Turkey over its incursions into the Syrian territory. Iran has made a blistering attack on U.S. President Joe Biden over his latest rhetoric against the country's nuclear program.
Irony of our times. Just on the anniversary of the first U.S. nuke test, and after visiting an outlaw regime that possesses clandestine nukes, Mr. Biden stresses that he would not allow Iran to build bombs. Sales pitch to charm the Israeli apartheid regime by bombs that Iran has never sought.
Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani was referring to Biden's remarks during his recent West Asia tour that included a visit to Israel. Biden said in a meeting with the acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid in Tel Aviv that Washington would use force to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. He later repeated his anti-Iran stance in Saudi Arabia on the second leg of his regional tour. Iran has time and again rejected allegations that it is in pursuit of nuclear weapons. Iran has also vowed a firm response to any military action against the Islamic Republic. On Monday, the naval commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps warned of a painful lesson to any act of aggression against the country. Brigadier General Ali Reza
Tang Sidi also said that Iran will nip the plots of the country's enemies in the bud. The United States says it will impose harsh consequences on countries that break or abuse what it calls the international economic order. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen hinted that Russia is challenging the order by its war in Ukraine. Yellen also said that the U.S. is pushing for increased trade ties with its allies to prevent what she called manipulation of supply chains in the world. The official also called for a united stance against Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The U.S. accuses Russia of having triggered the current food crisis in the world by preventing Ukraine's key wheat exports. Moscow says it is the U.S. sanctions that have caused the crisis. The U.S. has also failed to form an international coalition for a trade embargo on Russia. Oil markets have seen another jump in prices after the U.S. President Joe Biden failed to secure pledges for increased production during his weekend visit to Saudi Arabia. All major benchmarks were higher on Monday, with Brent rallying more than 4% to $105 a barrel. That's immediately after Biden arrived back home from his West Asia tour. Earlier during a presser in Jeddah, Biden told reporters to expect steps to reduce the price of oil in the coming weeks. But Saudi State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Adel Jubeir, downplayed that prospect. He said that any increase in production will hinge on a potential shortage in the oil market. The European Union approves another 500 million euros to supply arms to Ukraine, taking the bloc's total financial support for Kyiv to 2.5 billion euros. Now, there's growing disquiet in the bloc regarding the impact the sanctions against Russia are having on the EU's economy. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
EU foreign affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialize.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As Russia continues its advance in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas, Johnny Miller has traveled to a city which has seen some of the fiercest fighting of the war so far.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, this may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Jaromír Severodonetsk.
An amber warning for extreme heat issued in the UK, a country with a policy to rapidly reduce climate-damaging greenhouse gas emissions. But, as Saeed Pourreza reports, a combination of a cost of living crisis and the need to find a new prime minister is calling into question Britain's commitment to reaching net zero by the year 2050.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg climate dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Shia Muslims are celebrating Eid al-Qadir. The festivity marks the appointment of Ali ibn Abi Talib as the next Muslim leader after the Prophet Muhammad. From Tehran, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has this report.
Everyone is invited to this party that stretches for 10 kilometers in Tehran. As Shia Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Qadir, Iranians have got together in this festival to share the happy mood with each other.
This beautiful celebration has drawn many Iranians to enjoy Eid al-Qadir festivity together. I congratulate all my fellow Muslims on the Eid.
Happy Eid al-Qadir to all Muslims. We Shia Muslims regard this festivity as a chance to renew our allegiance with Imam Ali, our first Imam.
Eid al-Ghadir marks the beginning of Shia Islam some 14 centuries ago, when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib the first Shia imam as his successor and Muslims' next leader.
On Eid al-Ghadir, Prophet Muhammad raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Imam Ali was the cousin of Prophet Muhammad and is known as the first man to embrace the Prophet's call for Islam. According to Islamic references, Imam Ali rooted out poverty and promoted an unprecedented justice system across the Muslim world during his short rule based in Iraq's city of Kufa.
Imam Ali represents justice, humanity, and chivalry. During his rule, he eliminated sexual and racial discrimination and promoted kindness.
Here, not only do Iranians celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, they get to teach their kids about who Imam Ali was.
I named my son after Imam Ali. It's not just about his name. I like him to act and behave like Imam Ali. That's why I brought him to this ceremony. Imam Ali is a role model for all of us.
In Shia Islam, there are 12 imams or religious leaders, all believed to have preserved the legacy of the Prophet. Mahdi is the last imam who is believed to be the apocalyptic savior of the world and is currently living in occultation. To Muslims, Eid al-Ghadir is a time when God perfected their religion by introducing Imam Ali as their next leader. That's why they celebrate it every year to honor Imam Ali as the father of Shia Islam, a symbol of Islamic justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
People in Afghanistan have held different ceremonies to mark Eid al-Ghadir. Rahmatullah Bagman has more from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
Like every other Eid in Islamic calendar, Afghan Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir with diverse ceremonies. In one of the festivities on this occasion, a total of 70 couples tied the knot in a mass wedding in Kabul. The organizers of the ceremony and participants say that in addition to celebrating Eid al-Ghadir, the initiative was aimed to promote Islamic culture, ease marriage for the young generation, and to cut back on wedding expenses.
We had been engaged for some months. Due to economic problems, we couldn't marry in wedding halls individually. Then, as we were informed about this initiative, we happily enlisted ourselves here. It is very great. We feel very lucky as we are both celebrating Eid al-Ghadir and our mass wedding on the same day and festival.
I congratulate Eid al-Ghadir to all Muslims. As you know, on this day, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, appointed Imam Ali as his successor in Ghadir Khum. Here, our Muslim brothers have held this mass wedding of young couples to celebrate the occasion. I am very happy to be taking part here. I found it as an example of Islamic culture and simplicity, but super joyous.
In another festival, Kabul residents colorfully decorated the popular Imam Ali shrine to celebrate Eid al-Ghadir. They also offered prayers and stressed the importance of commemorating historical and religious events.
We have come here to enjoy Eid al-Ghadir vibes at Ziyarat-e-Sakhi. We said prayers and engage in festivities. On this day, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, designated Imam Ali as the next leader of Muslims after him. We mark this holy occasion every year, gathering together here for the love of our Imam. Today, we prayed for the well-being of Muslims and Afghan people.
However, Afghan people are going through different hardships, but such gatherings prove that their passion to mark important religious and cultural occasions has not been reduced. People here take Eid al-Ghadir as an opportunity to renew allegiance with their first imam. They also call for unity and solidarity among Muslims globally. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the day after the West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin scuttled plans to pass a climate and tax package, many in his party blamed him for the demise of their ambitions and expressed a lack of trust in him. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Emily Cochrane, Katie Edmondson, and Stephanie Lai. The piece is titled, Manchin Dangles Hopes of a Future Compromise, Democrats Revolt. Please stay with us for more. ¶¶ It was a familiar, if excruciating, position for Democrats. A day after pulling the plug on his party's plans to pass a climate, energy and tax package this summer, Senator Joe Manchin III of West Virginia, the conservative-leaning Democrat who has repeatedly flirted with compromise only to scuttle his party's highest ambitions, called in on Friday to a West Virginia radio show. Perhaps, he suggested, in another month or so, he might see his way clear to salvaging the last bits of President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. There was no guarantee, of course, and the comments were only the latest instance of Joe Manchin capitalizing on his role as a swing vote in an evenly divided Senate to dictate his party's legislative strategy, leaving Democrats at his mercy. This time, though, Democrats had had enough. Rather than engage in another round of will-he-or-won't-he negotiations with Mr. Manchin, President Biden let it be known that he was done trying to secure his climate agenda in Congress. Joe Manchin's abrupt withdrawal left Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and a majority leader, jilted after months of courting a colleague whose demands and red lines seemed to shift by the day, or the latest economic projection. And it prodded many Democrats into open revolt against Mr. Manchin, blaming him for the demise of their ambitions and the last chance for their party to tackle the existential threat of climate change. Joe Manchin, said Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has shown that he doesn't know how to close a deal, or he doesn't want to close a deal, and that you can't trust him. For more than a year, Joe Manchin, who at 74 is serving his third term in the Senate, has been situated exactly where he prefers to be, at the center of the high-stakes political and policy negotiation, with attention and speculation focused on him. Democrats have toiled to win his vote on any piece of their once ambitious domestic agenda, tailoring their policy moves so as not to alienate him. They have contorted themselves to suit his often changing dictates and have scaled back their ambitions repeatedly to stay within his red lines. But they have so far come away empty-handed on their biggest priorities. Because of Democrats' razor-thin margin of control in the 50-50 Senate and unified Republican opposition to most of their agenda, Joe Manchin has effective veto power over the party's legislative strategy and has exercised it often and unapologetically. But while President Biden and congressional Democrats have pushed for transformative policies to confront generational challenges such as climate change, Joe Manchin, who channels the desires of his very conservative coal and gas producing state, has focused on nearer term issues. On Friday, he said he had told party leaders he wanted to wait another month until inflation numbers for July were released, before he could decide on whether to act on climate change. "I am where I have been. I would not put my staff through this. I would not put myself through this if I wasn't sincere about trying to find a pathway forward to do something that's good for our country," Joe Manchin said on Friday in the interview with the radio host Hoppy Kershaval. "They cannot come to grips because I have a D by my name, or someone has an R by their name. We should do whatever one side wants. That's not me." President Biden made no mention of Joe Manchin in a statement issued on Friday. Asked at a news conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, whether the West Virginian senator had been negotiating in good faith, the president demurred, saying he was not the one who had been negotiating with him. But angry congressional Democrats pinned their frustration on the West Virginia Democrat. One senator, Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, mused publicly about whether Joe Manchin deserved his chairmanship of the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. It's been a really, really terrible day, Senator Tina Smith, Democrat of Minnesota and a key champion of climate provisions, said in an interview. If Senator Manchin wants a deal on climate and energy, he can have one in a heartbeat. This is Senator Manchin's deal for the taking, and if it doesn't happen, it is on him. On Capitol Hill, Joe Manchin is something of a unicorn, the only National Democrat from his ruby-red state, and acts and votes accordingly. Set to face voters in 2024, he is unlikely to be threatened by a primary challenger in a state former President Donald Trump won by nearly 40 percentage points in 2020. That has given Mr. Manchin leverage to accomplish his own policy goals, including holding firm against moving entirely away from oil and gas, and resist what he considers his party's lurch towards its liberal base. He appears happiest when he is in the middle of a consequential policy negotiation. He has been wined and dined as a crucial participant in bipartisan talks, invited to President Biden's Wilmington home for breakfast, and pursued by the White House officials, lawmakers, aides, and reporters who dissect his every syllable for a kernel of insight. But the murkiness and at times inconsistency of Joe Manchin's positions has increasingly grated on his Democratic colleagues. Barely 3 months into the Biden administration, he prompted the longest open vote in modern Senate history by raising a last-minute objection to the size of unemployment benefits in the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid plan. Democrats had to slash the jobless payments to win his vote, which cemented passage of the package. He refused to help Democrats change filibuster rules to enact voting rights legislation, killing the effort even after Chuck Schumer gave him the lead role in writing an alternative bill to ensure he would support it. But on no issue has Joe Manchin bedeviled Democrats more than on their ambitious social safety net, climate and tax package. To win his vote to begin work on the plan, Chuck Schumer signed on to a secret memo with Mr. Manchin that made clear that the West Virginian senator had no intention of accepting the $3.5 trillion in spending envisioned in Democrats' budget. The document outlined Joe Manchin's much narrower parameters for a $1.5 trillion package, including income thresholds for social programs and accommodations for fossil fuel tax credits and natural gas. "I will try to dissuade Joe on many of these," Chuck Schumer scrawled on the document, which enraged many Democrats when it became public. He never could. 6 months later, Joe Manchin abruptly walked away from talks on the package. Democrats regrouped in January and began efforts to rebuild their shattered plan, adhering strictly to the components that Joe Manchin had repeatedly laid out: paying down the national debt, overhauling parts of the tax code, and lowering the cost of prescription drugs by allowing Medicare to negotiate prices and some spending. By earlier this month, Senate Democrats had begun rolling out pieces of a package they believed could win Joe Manchin's support, including a drug pricing proposal and a plan to shore up the solvency of a key Medicare program by increasing taxes for some high-earning Americans. But by Thursday evening, 14th of July, after news that prices had surged 9.1% in the year ending in June, Joe Manchin balked again, telling Chuck Schumer that he wanted to wait on any climate or tax proposals until seeing inflation figures for the month of July. Should Democrats insist on pushing forward with legislative action before then, Joe Manchin said, they should act only on proposals aimed at lowering the cost of prescription drugs and extending expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies. Let's wait until that comes out so we know what we're going down the path. It won't be inflammatory to add more to inflation, Joe Manchin said in the radio interview. Recounting Chuck Schumer's response, Joe Manchin added, I said, Chuck, it's wrong. It's not prudent to do the other right now. I want climate. I want an energy policy, he said, adding, I thought we were moving truly in the right direction. But Chuck Schumer appeared to have grown exasperated and convinced that Joe Manchin's vote was not obtainable. One official said that Joe Manchin had rebuffed major concessions that would have enraged progressive Democrats, including adding more drilling measures, removing a key electric vehicle tax credit, and dropping tax increases he had resisted. Mr. Manchin's stance effectively scuttled the chances of action in the coming days on a critical priority for Democrats and strongly suggested that unless they abandon the climate and tax proposals altogether, they might not salvage any of their domestic policy package before the midterm congressional elections in November. In September, after a five-week planned recess, lawmakers will have only a limited window to act on the package, and they're eager to give themselves as much time as possible to campaign on whatever they pass before the November elections. Bearing political scars from a year of fractious talks, few Democrats on Friday, 15th of July, seemed willing to gamble that there was a larger deal to be had in September.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This show focuses on how the Palestine Solidarity Movement is under a constant barrage by the Zionist movement and its assets. Now, we must be doing something right, because we're now being subjected to direct attacks and smears from apologists for the crimes of the Zionist regime. Our YouTube channel has been deleted, and my own personal Twitter account has been labelled as Iran state-affiliated media. So today, we're looking at how Zionist groups have specifically targeted this programme, and we'll examine the broader efforts by the Zionist lobby to infiltrate and capture social media giants. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on the attacks on the Palestine Declassified and the organisation that's behind them.
Since January 2022, Palestine Declassified has reported every week on how the Zionist movement is engaged in a war on solidarity with the resistance to occupation of Palestine. Our reports have not gone unnoticed by the Zionists. Typically, rather than engage in debate and discussion as they claim to favor, the main public responses have been to deploy the Zionist weapon of choice, false allegations of anti-Semitism. But behind the scenes, Zionist lobbyists have been working with social media companies to have this program censored and marginalized. First, the YouTube channel was targeted in May. YouTube claimed that this was because of an unspecified terms of service violation. On the 18th of May, a British Israel lobby group, the Community Security Trust, claimed that it was behind the censorship. The next step was that the Twitter account of the program was labeled Iran state-affiliated media. But this was not enough. Next, the personal Twitter accounts of the presenter and producer of this program, Chris Williamson and David Miller, were labeled in the same way. Palestine Declassified has reported on several occasions about the Community Security Trust, a British charity that claims to focus on protecting British Jews from anti-Semitism. But in reality, runs point for the Zionist regime and spends most of its time targeting the left, Muslims and supporters of the liberation of Palestine. It is known to have been in regular contact with the Mossad spy agency and assiduously compiles spy files on British campaigners against Zionism, including holding many files on anti-Zionist Jews. These files are used to defame and deplatform anyone who criticizes the Zionist regime or its henchmen in the UK, such as the CST. Its relations with Twitter go beyond simply submitting complaints to the social media giant. Since 2015, the CST and Twitter have worked together, with Twitter executives referring to the CST as empowering Twitter to take action. The CST includes amongst its charitable objectives that it campaigns against extremism. But it defines extremism in such a narrow way that it excludes even the wildest Zionist extremism. Recently, for example, it offered counter-terror advice to a Zionist sect, Shabad, after the group was described accurately as extremist. Shabad is held by the Zionist intelligence agency Shin Bet to be responsible for most price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians, including murders. Of course, the CST will not take any action against such extremism, not least because CST founder, the convicted fraudster Gerald Ronson, funnels money to Shabad from his family foundation.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David co-founded and he's a co-director of Spinwatch, which is a lobbying watchdog. We're also joined from Nottingham today by Amar Kazmi. Amar is a master's student in law and a political activist. In a previous life, he worked as a political advisor in my parliamentary office when I was a member of parliament. We recorded Amar's responses earlier. Welcome to the show. David, let me come to you first. This is your old friend, the Community Security Trust, up to its old tricks again, isn't it? Can you just remind our viewers what the CST is and how it's waged its years-long campaign against you in particular?
Well, the CST says that it's set up to target anti-Semitism against Jews in Britain. But it can't tell the difference, or rather it refuses to tell the difference between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So that means that most of its activity is taken up with targeting the left, targeting Muslims, and targeting others who are critical of Israel's activities. So that's its difficulty in a nutshell. But in particular in relation to me, I gave evidence against the CST, an expert evidence in 2011 on the case of a Palestinian politician who the Home Office were trying to deport. Mm. And the CST had given evidence in that case, which was false, and I pointed this out, and they lost the case. And they've not liked that. And so ever since then, they've tried to, whenever they can, attack me. And in particular, they started to attack me in a new way in 2019 when they made a first complaint to the University of Bristol, and that eventually led some 3 years later to me being sacked by the University of Bristol. So they have a history, right? We have a history together, and so it's not a surprise to learn then that they're attacking us again. They're trying to get this program's social media interfered with. They've labelled your Twitter account, your personal Twitter account, my personal Twitter account with Iran state-affiliated media. We don't work for Press TV. We come and do some work for them occasionally. And so it's an absurdity, but it's clear that they are targeting us specifically as opposed to anyone who works for Press TV. So there's a clue there. They're targeting people who they think are a threat to their activities. And, you know, I'm glad of that they think we're a threat.
No, indeed. And obviously trying to do their best to delegitimise us. When we spoke to Ammar, we asked him if he thought the Israel lobby had played a part in my removal from the Labour Party.
Britain's Israel lobby played an extensive role in removing you, not just from the Labour Party, but I would also say from mainstream parliamentary politics. And to conceptualise that, I think it's important just to spell out, you know, in this context, what we mean by Britain's Israel lobby. I mean, it's not just some sort of mysterious group. They largely, as we know, act in the open. And by lobby, we're talking about the so-called Jewish labor movement, Labor Friends of Israel, We Believe in Israel, which is an outfit run by Luke Akers, who now sits on Labour's highest governing body, the self-proclaimed Board of Deputies of British Jews, the Jewish Leadership Council, and so many other organizations, including the Community Security Trust, the Union of Jewish Students, and other student societies. And all of those groups are pro-Israel and Zionist, and they have demonstrable links to the Israeli embassy in Britain.
We also asked him, as someone who'd worked closely with me when I was in Parliament, if it was any surprise to him that the campaign against me has continued even after I left Parliament.
It's not surprising to me at all that they continue to attack you and so many others, because Zionism is a maximalist ideology. And by that, I mean that if you give them an inch, they will take a mile. They are, to put it mildly, a hungry pack of wolves who have bottomless stomachs, and they're never satisfied with whatever meat is thrown in their direction. And that's why the appeasement strategy that Jeremy Corbyn pursued was a total failure, because he thought, and the people around him mistakenly believed, that if they apologized and if they threw their own allies like yourself under the bus, that these Zionist zealots would somehow stop their attacks. And of course, that was simply an invitation to them to continue with those attacks, which is why Jeremy Corbyn is now, ironically, in the same position in which he placed you under his leadership. He's not a Labour MP anymore. And if we're realistic, he's never going to be allowed to take back his position on the Labour benches until he's eventually out of Parliament. You know, Corbyn is a man, let's remember, who, of course, helped to reinvigorate Labour politics. He saw a huge increase in the Labour vote in the 2017 general election. He grew the party's membership levels to unprecedented scales. And this is now how he's being treated. You know, I've previously called it a forever war against Corbyn and against the people who supported him. And these fanatics are determined, basically, to ensure that being pro-Palestine is never again an acceptable position in public life.
David, what do you make of the selective nature of these attacks? I mean, they seem to be outside the charitable remit of the CST, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they're engaged in an attempt to get a programme, this programme labelled as Iran state-affiliated media. It's got nothing at all to do with their charitable objectives, which are to do with fighting anti-Semitism on the one hand, and on the other hand, fighting extremism. There's no extremism in this programme. It's the evidence-based commentary, which people might disagree with, but which, you know, is clearly nothing to do with extremism. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the CST itself does show evidence, considerable evidence, of itself being an extremist organisation and not understanding that there is such a thing as extremism in the far reaches of the Zionist community. This organisation, Chabad, that they have been briefing with counter-terror advice because I called them extremist. I mean, that's an extraordinary position. This is an extremist organisation they should be monitoring, but instead they're giving them counter-terror advice as if I'm some kind of terror threat to this extreme Zionist organisation. That's an absurdity. And we face, you know, the potential I think as a result of these kinds of activities, of the CST's charitable status looking a little bit wobbly. Well, let's see how that goes.
Yes, indeed. Well, we also asked Amar about the fact that as the CST were fully embedded in the Labour Party during the Corbyn years, giving anti-Semitism workshops, etc., when did it become apparent to Amar that the Labour Party had been entirely captured and was working effectively as an internal surveillance system?
The Labour Party was already captured by pro-Israel interests before Corbyn was elected Labour leader in 2015. The former Labour Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, visited the Knesset in Tel Aviv in 2008, in which he said that Britain would always stand firmly by Israel's side. So Corbyn's election in 2015 was, in fact, a very brief, limited rupture in pro-Israel consensus in the Labour Party. But that was tamed very early on in his leadership. At the beginning of 2016, there was a manufactured scandal in the Oxford University Labour Club about supposed anti-Semitism. And Corbyn's instinct, unfortunately, was to commission Baroness Janet Royal, who had links with Labour Friends of Israel, to conduct an inquiry. And then we saw this same cowardly approach being taken in relation to his longtime ally and friend, the former Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. And so his disposition to try to run away or to kick these issues into the long grass, of course, whilst throwing his own friends to the wolves, was pretty much set in stone at that point. And it pretty much just got worse from there. The British state truly is, you know, parliamentary interests are largely on this issue, dictated by two groups, Labour Friends of Israel and Conservative Friends of Israel, which boasts hundreds of parliamentary members between them. And these groups are, of course, directly linked to the Israeli embassy. And many of the MPs that are in those groups often go on all expenses paid trips to the State of Israel, and they receive donations from them. In fact, a former Conservative minister under Theresa May, Sir Alan Duncan, wrote in his diaries, which have been published, that he had been subject, in his own words, to the most disgusting interference from pro-Israel lobbyists. And he said, and I quote, "They will interfere at a high level in British politics in the interests of Israel on the back of donor power in the UK." So really, it's no surprise that these characters in Parliament and in government would then give millions of pounds to an Israel lobbying group. And it also shows that the tail now wags the dog. You know, the Israel lobby in Britain dictates to the British government and not the other way around.
David, given everything that you've learnt about the CST, I mean, would it be fair to describe it as an extremist organisation?
I think we're now in the territory of being able to describe it that way. I think I don't think I realised quite how extreme this organisation was until really comparatively recently. Yeah. I mean, I've discovered recently the origins of the alleged anti-racist group which led eventually to the creation of the CST, which back in the 1940s signed up en masse to the ERGON, the Revisionist Zionist Terrorist Organisation. And the CST comes effectively some decades later out of that milieu. And we see now the way in which they are advising extremist organisations as if they are the victims of extremism. So there's a really difficulty here, is that it appears to be a liberal anti-racist organisation, but in the end it's defending some really quite extreme activities in occupied Palestine, including, you know, actual revenge murders of Palestinians.
Indeed. Well, we're just going to pause there for a moment and have a look at this report on how Zionist groups have been colonising and attempting to capture Twitter on behalf of the Zionist entity.
Social media giants are hostile territory for the Palestinian cause. But it's not just that Zionist groups target pro-Palestinian accounts en masse for closure. In fact, some social media giants have Zionist groups embedded in their advisory system. Take the example of Twitter. In 2015, Twitter launched a safety center and listed a number of trusted partners in the US, Australia, and Europe. In the area of offensive speech, it listed the following groups concerned with anti-Semitism: the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions, Le CRIF, the International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism, LICRA in France, Community Security Trust, the CST, in the UK, and Anti-Defamation League, ADL, in the US. All of these groups are strongly Zionist and follow the line of the Zionist regime in matters of anti-Semitism, which is to present it as identical to anti-Zionism. Among the extensive number of groups advising Twitter, there were no groups challenging anti-Palestinian racism. There was only one group that claimed to represent the interest of Muslims, Muslim Advocates. This is a US-based group that is full of former financial services and consulting staff and seems to have an aversion to the use of the word Islamophobia. It's funded by Mackenzie Bezos, the former wife of the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, and by a number of liberal foundations. Its weak stance is complemented by its collaboration with progressive Zionist groups like Bend the Ark Jewish Action, whose largest donor is Alexander Soros, the son of financier, philanthropist, and regime change enthusiast George Soros. Amongst its activities, it's made allegations of anti-Semitism against the pop star Taylor Swift, which were false. From 2018, the list of groups evolved. It still included the ADL in the US, European Jewish Information Center, the CEJI in Brussels, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews in the UK. The CEJI is a Zionist organization and advertises that it works closely with a range of Zionist groups as partners, including B'nai B'rith in Europe, the Dutch Center for Documentation and Information on Israel, the CST in London, the European Union of Jewish Students, LICRA in France, and others. Amongst its funders are Google, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitter itself, a significant conflict of interest. The Board of Deputies states in its 2020 annual report that it has a close working relationship with the Embassy of Israel in the UK and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the IDF. If you want to know why Twitter is hostile to Palestinian rights, look no further than its structural relationship with hardline Zionist groups, which give them a stranglehold over the access of voices in support of the liberation of Palestine.
David, surely it can't be right, can it, for Twitter to take advice on critics of Israel exclusively from groups that are essentially just apologists for Zionist crimes?
Well, you would think so, but here we are, and this is how it works. These are, as you say, apologists for Zionist crimes, and they're advising on which people can speak on matters of Palestinian rights. It's absolutely extraordinary. If there was some kind of balance in there, if they had, I don't know, Palestine Solidarity groups, you know, checking some of this stuff and checking the extremist Zionist content on Twitter, which is a lot, then you might have a different sort of argument. I wouldn't go all the way with that, but you might have a different argument. But we don't. All we have is Zionist groups who have an effective stranglehold over what's admissible on Twitter. That's not an open platform. That's no kind of social media freedom. That is absolutely a propaganda platform.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, turning to Amor again, I mean, we asked him why there's such a lack of critical thinking about what exactly the Israel lobby is in this country.
I think that many people, especially people on the British left, regrettably, are uncomfortable coming to terms with the reality of the Israel lobby in this country, because they would have to then reevaluate what their idea of imperialism is, how imperialism works in the 21st century, and who wields power and what that looks like. And they'd also have to confront the fact that the Zionist project is an imperial one. The state of Israel is not simply a state in the conventional sense. And I don't think they want, frankly, the moral burden of confronting that reality. And I'd also say more broadly that people in general have been so taken in by the smear campaign that they either genuinely believe in it or they're, you know, paralyzed by fear of the consequences of taking a stand against this hostile foreign interference in our politics.
David, what about these Muslim advocates groups? I mean, do you think that provides any balance in the decision-making process at all?
Well, no, there's this one organization. It's a US-based, very well-heeled organization, as the film showed, with people from the financial services sector, from the consultancy industry, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, and their material is weak. They do some court cases which have a you know a sort of civil rights approach, but they also you know collaborate with the liberal Zionist organizations which are engaged in the anti-Semitism witch hunt. I mean that example of Taylor Swift there was a particularly egregious example. I mean, Taylor mm-hmm. Swift had complained that Soros had been involved in releasing an album of hers without her permission, and she referred to this in relation, and she used the word greed. And they immediately said, oh, that's a trope. Yeah. That's a trope about Jewish greedy people. And you're like, no, it's not. This is completely absurd. And so, you know, an advocate group for Muslims focusing on Islamophobia should have nothing to do with organizations like that. So it's really not a proper Muslim advocacy organization. Right. And that gives the lie to the whole project.
Sure. Yeah. Well, finally, we asked Amar what he would say to the social media companies who are placing this trust in the Israel lobby to police speech on their platforms.
Well, I think it's very dangerous, and I would say it's less about trust, and it's more about this concept of capture, as we've been discussing. You know, in many ways, the Israel lobby, in Britain at least, use the Labour Party as a sort of incubator for its tactics, which they've then exported not just to social media companies, but in universities, trade unions. And internationally, you know, the State of Israel has been working very hard as a diplomatic objective to capture social media companies to the point where now they effectively outsource their judgment on Palestine-related issues to proxies of the Israeli government.
Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you've found it informative. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.